This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. It was in July 2013 that three African-American women, Patrice Cullors, Opal Tometi, and Alicia Garza, who were prominent activists in their communities, joined together and coined the simple yet powerful refrain, Black Lives Matter. It happened in response to the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the killing of Trayvon Martin. A year later, an uprising in Ferguson, Missouri over the police killing of Michael Brown catapulted the phrase and the activists empowered by it into a movement. The three women co-founders of BLM have received accolades, been interviewed in major media outlets, invited to give speeches, and much more. But throughout it all, they've stuck to their principles and inspired a new generation of activists. Now, as we approach the three-year anniversary of Black Lives Matter, I'm so pleased to welcome to the program Alicia Garza. She is the Special Projects Director in the Oakland office of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She serves on the Board of Directors for the School of Unity and Liberation in Oakland, California, and is also a contributing writer for War Times magazine. And she is, of course, one of the three co-founders of Black Lives Matter. Welcome to the program, Alicia.
Thanks for having me.
So 3 years after you and your colleagues coined this phrase, how do you assess both its victories and its challenges? And of course, 3 years is a short period of time in the grand scheme of things, but it seems as though within that period, BLM has totally changed the conversation in the country on race and police brutality. But the question is, given that we are still not seeing actual convictions of cops who kill, has it been a game changer in practical terms?
I think a lot of the game changing is happening in the sense of there's a cultural shift that is moving through this country. And as we know, cultural shifts are often necessary for real policy change to happen. What we know, for example, in 2015, there were more than 40 new laws in 26 states across this country addressing criminal justice reform. And when we look at where those laws fit on the spectrum of whether we like them or whether we didn't like them, we'll see that there's a big range there. But certainly, we think that one of the big changes that has happened is that race, policing, and the multiple ways in which state-sanctioned violence impacts our communities has become an issue that is front and center. Even though people have been organizing around these issues for decades, we're seeing for the first time in many, many years, a real rich and necessary conversation happening across the political spectrum about what do we do about the fact that Black lives don't actually matter in this country.
Should we measure the success of the movement in the long term through things like laws that are favorable to communities, convictions of police who actually harm people, or is asking the question of measuring the success of the movement the wrong question to begin with?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at transformation. So for many people, they want to see immediate results. And I think what we're seeing in this period is more of an exposure of all of the ways in which these various systems that are interlocking are failing us, they're failing our communities, and certainly it's failing our democracy. When we think about what change looks like, to be honest with you, prosecuting or convicting a few police officers doesn't actually transform the system itself. And those officers are products of those systems. And so for us, it's really important that we understand transformation, one, on a much longer trajectory, two, as being as in the interrelationship between culture change and policy change, and three, a reimagining of alternatives that get put into place for systems that we are trying to dismantle. So ultimately, there are conversations that still need to be had about what is the function and role of policing supposed to be. Most people think that police are meant to keep them safe, but yet the experience of people, particularly in Black communities, in Brown communities, in poor communities, etc., is that police are not actually keeping you safe. In fact, in many cases, police are the ones who may be ending up terrorizing communities themselves. And so a fundamental reimagining of policing and many of the systems that we're calling attention to is necessary to measure fundamental change.
Right. In the short term, though, wouldn't convictions, or actually just first charging and then actual convictions of killer cops, be somewhat of a deterrent, somewhat of a warning to police that you no longer can get away with killing people because there's been so much impunity for so long? You know, there's so many killings each year, so few charges, of those charges, almost no convictions. Wouldn't convictions at least start to send the message, we're watching you and you will go to prison if you continue to kill?
I think it's part of the solution, but it's not the full one. Hmm. For example, here in Oakland, there, when Oscar Grant was murdered, the police officer who killed Oscar Grant was actually prosecuted, and he was convicted. And he spent just a few short months in jail before he was then released and is now fighting to be reinstated as a police officer. And then, of course, we see that in the context of the many scandals that exist within the Oakland Police Department that have come to light as of recently. So I think what we have to understand is that convictions are a step, but they are not the step to reforming and, to be quite frank, transforming how policing is operating in our communities.
Right.
There are many different things that need to happen throughout police departments in order to really send a clear message that it is unacceptable to be killing people in the course of, quote unquote, keeping people safe.
Right. Yeah. Right. Now, in the context of the cultural shift that Black Lives Matter has enacted that you were mentioning earlier, do you feel that that has emboldened people to speak out so much more than they ordinarily would? I'm thinking of the actor Jesse Williams, who made a very powerful and unapologetic public statement at the BET Awards about racism and police brutality and white supremacy. What did you make of his words and just the act of him saying it?
You know, I think it's really important that people in positions of power, whether it be people who are in the entertainment industry or people who are elected to make decisions on our behalf, are speaking out about the issues that are important and impacting our communities. I thought Jesse's speech was incredible. I also have a lot of love for people like Beyoncé, who have been making incredible statements with her art and her music around the conditions our communities are facing. People like Kendrick Lamar, right? There's tons of folks now, right, who are taking a stand and making sure that everybody knows, right, that we are grappling with this fundamental question of dignity and humanity in this country. Of course, when actors and entertainers do that, it sends a particular wave of shock through their industry, right, but also through the communities that love them, right, through the television screens or through the internet. And that's important. It's an important component to organizing. We saw this also during the last period of civil rights, with people like Harry Belafonte and Muhammad Ali, right, making really public statements about the state of race relations in this country. So I'm excited that tradition is continuing. I'm excited to continue to lift up and support folks who are in positions of power, who use those platforms for social good.
Is Black Lives Matter about more than just police brutality? You mentioned dignity and humanity. You're based in Oakland, where the issue of gentrification is all too real, particularly when it comes to the tech industry that's moving in. Do you see gentrification and police abuse as being intimately linked, also linked with things like, of course, employment, poverty, the broader issues that don't have the drama of police violence but are still part of the equation?
Absolutely. I mean, from the beginning, we've talked about Black Lives Matter not just as a network or even a movement that is trying to address police violence, but instead we've framed it very broad as state-sanctioned violence, which includes things like gentrification and displacement, certainly includes things like high unemployment rates or a racialized segregation of employment. And for us, we see all of those things interrelated. You know, you can't separate police violence from gentrification and displacement, because police violence and policing is often used to help bolster those processes. You know, I've been an organizer here in the Bay Area for more than a decade, working on issues of gentrification, displacement, economic justice, gender justice, and racial justice. And always when a community is undergoing a transformation to try and bring in a new class of people to bolster the economy locally, it comes with an increase in policing. Policing is used then to clear that area, right, of the existing element that is undesirable for the potential new occupants. So that's one example of how these issues are linked. And I think Black Lives Matter from the beginning has been very clear that we're not just a movement that is concerned about police brutality. We are a movement that is concerned about the dignity and humanity of all life, and in particular, Black life.
You know, what's really interesting is that tech workers often tend to be liberal, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world who will claim Black Lives Matter. You know, he was at the Pride Parade. So there seems to be a dissonance between the impacts on their own lives and their politics when it comes to sort of white, well-educated liberals who might say Black Lives Matter, but then call the cops on the homeless guy in front of their apartment building. Can you comment on that?
Sure. I mean, my experience has been that lots of the folks in tech actually kind of sit in a political spectrum between liberal and libertarian, which is quite a wide spectrum. And certainly there is a dissonance, right? So when I was organizing in San Francisco, what we saw was that, you know, there was lots of talk around social justice and fairness, but yet there was almost a separate and unequal way of engaging with the community that tech was really pushing. A specific example of that is, you know, in San Francisco, we had a crumbling public transportation system, but yet the tech industry was able to set up its own private public transit system for its workers using the public infrastructure to do it and not actually paying their fair share. So certainly there's a dissonance there. And I think even when we think about the policies of surveillance, right, on these very platforms like Facebook, there is a dissonance between the targeting of Black Lives Matter activists using platforms like Facebook and some of the values that the founder of that company has espoused. So part of what we need to be thinking about is how do we close the gap between what people are saying and what they're actually doing? And that certainly is a part of our work as well.
Right. In Oakland, just this past month, there's been just this crazy police scandal linked to prostitution and a very high turnover of police chiefs, 3 police chiefs in 2 weeks. And I'm wondering if you can comment on that issue and put it in a broader framework. Do you feel that this story at its heart is an indication of how police themselves don't follow the law and order that they claim they're enforcing, that it's not just about a sex scandal, which is how the media has been casting it, that it's deeper than that?
It's absolutely deeper than that. And there is a culture of corruption inside of the Oakland Police Department that spans decades, quite frankly. When I first started organizing here in this community more than 15 years ago, there was a scandal inside of the department where there was an actual gang inside of the OPD that called themselves the Riders that planted drugs and other paraphernalia on Black and brown people in poor communities throughout Oakland and secured a ton of convictions. They were also moving and selling drugs, right? And when they were exposed, they were charged and convicted, but yet several of them fled the country and haven't been seen since. Oakland has had many, many of these types of scandals, and it's deeply rooted inside of the department itself. So this recent set of scandals, let's say, because this isn't the only one, certainly we've had scandals around how OPD interacted with the Occupy movement. And in fact, there was a veteran who was shot in the, I believe he was shot in the head with a beanbag cannon, right? And we've had several other incidents, you know, the murder of Lavelle Mixon and the murder of Oscar Grant, right? So, I mean, that was BART police, but certainly we have to be clear that this is not just a one-off incident, but in fact, Oakland police have been under scrutiny for a long time because of a deep-seated level of corruption within the department. I don't want to just narrow it in on Oakland, though, because to be clear, the recent scandals that have come to light in Oakland were actually scandals that spanned four different cities in the Bay Area, where a young 18-year-old girl was being passed around between officers in four different cities in this community. So we have to be really, really clear that this isn't a one-off incident. This isn't a an issue of bad apples, right? But certainly it's a cultural issue where this has been acceptable for a long time, where the police are allowed to police themselves, and in fact, they're allowed to be judge, jury, and executioner, particularly when it comes to poor and working class Black and brown communities here in our city.
And yet, because of the way our society is structured, the police are supposed to be the force and are often, you know, and are always resorted to as a force to protect us. Black Lives Matter recently backed out of participating in the San Francisco Gay Pride Parade, where it had been invited to be Grand Marshal. And I understand that that was basically because of the heavy level of police presence at that parade in the wake of the Orlando shooting in Florida at the Pulse nightclub. How do communities of color find safety from both police and vigilante violence, terrorism, hate crimes, etc.? Because right now we're just given one of two choices. You know, if you turn back police or if you turn away police protection, you leave yourself open to the Omar Mateens of the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's an interesting frame. And one of the things that I think is important for us to understand about the shooting in Orlando is that it's been used to generate a level of fear and hysteria around terrorists, quote unquote, and also gun violence that is actually prevalent in different places in our communities. But I think that the frame of needing police because we're trying to prevent something from happening, like what happened at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, is actually a false frame. To be quite honest with you, it's being used to generate a level of fear that then helps to bolster the argument that we need more police and that type of aggressive policing is needed in order to solve problems. For us, it was really important that we stuck to our values around, number one, what is this Pride Parade supposed to be? It is supposed to be a celebration of resistance and a riot that ensued after police were beating and killing queer people. So we can't talk out of both sides of our mouths there, right? The second piece is we have to be very, very clear. There were so many layers to what happened at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando that it's important not to, for us to not devolve into the fear that's being generated around us being killed randomly. The reality is most gun violence, most crime, right? Most types of violence happen between people who know each other, who have some kind of relationship, who are in proximity to one another. And this is a trend that has been happening across the country where in the name of preventing quote unquote terrorism, or in the name of preventing violence, we are then sanctioning particular types of violence that end up actually increasing the levels of violence in our communities rather than decreasing them. And so that's why we need to think differently about the role of police, right? The role of police is not necessarily to be keeping us safe, right? The role of police is to solve problems. And if they're not doing that well, then we need to figure out different ways to solve problems that keep our communities whole, that don't break up families, and that don't put our community members and our loved ones 6 feet under the ground.
I'm so appreciative of your taking, you know, and turning that question around, because that isn't often how it's being cast in the media. And I want to ask you, Alicia, 3 years after you and Patrice Cullors and Opal Tometi kind of brought this simple refrain, Black Lives Matter, into the spotlight and made it public, made it a rallying cry. How has it changed your activism? Because you didn't begin your activism with that. You've been, and your two colleagues, of course, have all three of you have been longtime activists, and that sort of wisdom that you've gathered through your years as activism has been brought to the table. After Ferguson, mainstream news outlets covered your story, your role in Black Lives Matter. You've been interviewed in Cosmopolitan magazine, you know, gotten awards. Has all of that attention helped or hurt your organizing work?
You know, I think it's a little bit of both, to be honest with you. In some ways, it's helpful because it helps us get a message out to more people than who already agree with us, right? And that's always an Achilles heel, I think, in organizing, where you end up talking to people who already agree with you rather than moving people who may be on the fence about which side that they're on. So in some ways, that level of increased exposure has helped to get this message out to a broader audience than could have happened, right, through some of the more traditional methods of organizing. At the same time, I think that people can confuse visibility with power, right? Even though we've been interviewed in, you know, multiple outlets, even though we've had opportunities to have a level of visibility, the reality is the conditions in our communities are not that different. And so we can't mistake having that level of visibility for a level of political power, which is actually what we're going for. And then to be quite honest with you, in some ways, having that level of visibility really opens you up to a level of scrutiny that I think, you know, none of us could have anticipated. And that level of scrutiny is from everything from, you know, what color your hair is or how you looked on a particular thing. I mean, it brings out all kinds of really interesting layers of feedback. But one thing I feel really grateful for, and I think this is true for Opal and Patrice as well, is that we were able to be a part of a historical moment in this country and in this world where finally we are grappling with the questions of the impacts of white supremacy, of patriarchy, of transphobia, of heteronormativity, right? Of all of these systems that are really having real impacts on everyday people's lives. And we feel grateful to be able to be alive in this moment where we are trying to create the solutions and the alternatives to build the kind of world that we all deserve, a world where we fundamentally can live with dignity and respect for all human beings.
You talked about the issue of power, which is, of course, the ultimate goal. Let's talk about the election playing out this year. Do you feel that social movements are often too distracted by the question of who to vote for? But of course, that said, who is in the White House does matter, especially as we saw with the recent slew of Supreme Court decisions that have great impacts. The president gets to choose the Supreme Court justices as just one of many ways in which our lives are impacted. But it feels as though liberals and progressives often get very seduced by backing political candidates rather than demanding candidates back us. Early in the campaign, Black Lives Matter seemed to really share an important lesson about confronting candidates to have them back you. So your thoughts on the election this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really helpful frame, right? That really what we're trying to do is transform democracy overall, and that, you know, the systems that we're living under and that we're participating in are clearly not liberatory, and I don't know many people that would argue that they are. At the same time, I think what we have to be really concerned about in this election year is, you know, what kind of regime are we trying to be under, right? And I think that there's a way in which the sentiment around Donald Trump, particularly on our side of the of things, is not serious enough, and it is important, actually, for us to participate, and it's not for the sake of getting cozy with either party. It's for the sake of choosing the terrain on which we fight. And so, quite frankly, there is a different kind of terrain under a Clinton presidency than there is under a Trump presidency. That doesn't mean that one is better than the other, to be very clear, but it means that the terrains are different. And then fundamentally, if we're really about building power, then we have to be able to move people to move our agenda. And certainly, when the majority of people who can in this country do participate in a very broken two-party system where voting is the way that you make your voice heard, it is important to engage on that terrain as well. So for us, we are really focused on making sure that we're directing our energies not in the project of building either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but we're making sure that we're engaged in the project of building political power for Black people that is independent of both parties, but that is also moving our agenda. We're going to make sure, for example, that prosecutors who are putting our people in jail, who are not prosecuting killer cops, are not being reelected. As one example of something that you can do in this electoral cycle, particularly if you're sick of the conversation about what's happening at the president level. The other thing that I think is just really important to name is that it's not just the president that's up for election. All of the House is up for election. Several Senate seats are up for election. What happens with the presidency will certainly impact what's happening at the Supreme Court level, of which there will be at least two appointees for whoever gets elected in November. And then, of course, there's everything that's happening locally. And when we look at the right and we look at conservatives, they control 70% of our state houses across the country. They have power. And so if we are really looking to figure out how we change the conditions in our communities, I think it's incumbent upon us to take this terrain very, very seriously.
Alicia, I want to thank you so much for spending this time with us, and good luck to you and all of your work.
Thank you so much. Appreciate being on.
Alicia Garza is a special projects director at the Oakland office of the National Domestic Workers Alliance. She serves on the board of directors for the School of Unity and Liberation in Oakland. She's a contributing writer for War Times magazine. And of course, she is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, along with Patrice Cullors and Opal Tometi. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com.